Step into the spotlight of Sans Showbiz, guiding you through the stories behind the stars with Nigel Clarkson. Rod Clements from Lindisfarne chats with Nigel on Sans Showbiz podcast.
Hello, Rod.
Hello, Nigel. Hello, everybody.
Great to have you on the show. Thanks for spending the time with us here at Sans Showbiz. You're about to get under a massive 60-date tour that's coming up in the UK. Are you prepared? You start tomorrow, don't you?
We do. Yeah, we're going down to Leicester tomorrow for the first of four gigs. I'm spending the day, you know, changing strings and packing my suitcase and all that kind of thing. But yeah, really looking forward to it.
Yeah. All started in the 70s, didn't it? How did you all get together?
Well, we started off, in the beat group craze of the very early 60s, I suppose. Two local friends, like Simon Cowell and Ray Laidlaw, lived a couple of streets away from me in North Shields, and we fancied starting a little group. We went through the Shadows phase, the Beatles, the Kinks, and then when we got into the Rolling Stones, we discovered the blues, got further into that, became a Chicago blues band called the Downtown Faction, and we were quite serious about it, actually, and did quite well. Managed to get quite a profile around Tyneside and a bit further afield.
Yeah.
But around about 69, that kind of music was a bit unfashionable in terms of getting gigs.
Yeah.
People were moving more towards the sort of Led Zeppelin, heavy metal sound, and disco and glam, of course, and all that.
Yeah.
And we didn't fancy any of that, so we took a left turn into playing acoustic blues. Robert Johnson, Woody Guthrie, Leadbelly, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that led us into the folk clubs, which was quite a thriving scene in the Northeast. And one club in particular was run by Alan Hull and his manager.
Yeah.
In Whitley Bay. Now, Alan already had quite a profile on Tyneside as a singer-songwriter. He'd been in a band called The Chosen Few, who'd had a couple of singles out. Now he'd kind of reinvented himself as a solo acoustic singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
We went along and played at his club, and by this time we had Ray Jackson playing harmonica extremely well and mandolin. We went down pretty well with Alan and his audience.
Yeah.
And to such an extent, Alan asked us to go and play on some of the demos he was making at his manager's studio.
Right.
Which we did. One thing led to another, and we came together as a band, which eventually became called Lindisfarne.
Of course, that's an island, isn't it? Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, it's a tidal island off the coast of Northumberland, North Northumberland.
How did you come to decide we're going to call ourselves that?
Well, to be honest, it wasn't our idea. We were actually called Brethren at the time.
Yeah.
And the record company said, you can't be called that because there's an American band called Brethren and they're going to be huge.
Right.
Needless to say, nobody ever heard any more of the American Brethren. But we had to change our name, and we were trying to think of something. We were knocking about at home rehearsing with the John Anthony, the guy who became our first record producer.
Yeah.
And we were trying to think of a name, and somebody mentioned that they'd been up to Lindisfarne at the weekend.
Right.
And he said, what was that? And we said, Lindisfarne. And he said, that sounds like a great name for you guys.
Fantastic that, though, isn't it? How it came about.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we thought it was a bit strange. It'd be a bit like calling yourselves Wall's End or... But it had a nice sound to it, and it kind of reflected the band's ethos, I guess, in a way. Because it's an island, it's a bit cut off.
Yeah.
But it's connected at the same time, and it's got a sense of history about it. And I have to say, the name has served us very well over the years.
Yeah, it certainly has. It's been a lot of changes as well along the road, hasn't it, Rod? Because it's a long time going back to like the early 70s right up to date. It's been a fair few changes in the band.
Well, there have indeed, yeah. Sadly, we lost Alan Hull in 1995
yeah.
And Cy Cowell 8 or 9 years ago. But the band broke up and reconvened a few times.
Yeah.
But this lineup has been together now as it is since 2015. I'm the only original member, but the guy who stands at the front alongside of me and sings Alan's songs is Alan's son-in-law, Dave Holdenham.
It's an amazing story, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is great. He's really soaked up his father-in-law's influences. I mean, they worked together as a duo before Alan died. And Dave had a major hand in producing Alan's last solo album, which he was actually making when he died.
Yeah.
So he's a great asset to the Lindisfarne heritage.
So he'll know the sound as well, won't he? The sound of how they, you know, because he sounds exactly, he sounds a perfect fit, doesn't he, for Lindisfarne, the voice?
Absolutely. People say they close their eyes and they think it's Alan.
Yeah. So, yeah, you've had a lot of change along the way, but how many's in the band at the moment?
Five.
Five of you, yeah.
But everybody in the band now has got a long history with Lindisfarne. Steve Daggett on keyboards and things first toured with us as an additional member back in the 80s. Ian Thompson's been playing bass for the band since the mid-90s. And Paul Smith, the drummer, who hasn't been a full-time member that long, actually played on a couple of Alan's solo albums in the 80s and 90s. So we've all known each other for years, and we'll all get on well. And,
yeah, have a good time when you're out on the road as well.
We do.
I was going to ask you, Rod, how many guitars have you got personally?
I think it's about 35.
That's amazing. You always have your favourite, though, have you?
Horses for Courses. I'm very into early Japanese electric guitars. I've got a couple, a brand called Taisko. One of those, an early 60s one, is my main stage guitar for slide. I've got an old Harmony acoustic, which I love. Ooh, what else have I got? I've got a Martin acoustic, standard tuning, and a little Kent electric mandolin, again, early Japanese.
Yeah, distinct sound, that.
Yeah, well, I like sort of off-the-wall instruments, you know.
Yeah.
And I say, when you ask me how many I had, and I have to think and say about so-and-so, I can't give an exact figure because some of them are in bits.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, you're going to have a house full there then, aren't you? Certainly with 35 or so.
I have got a bit of a house full of them, yeah.
As you're going through the career of the band, anyway, you had some fantastic songs, didn't you? You've always had some fantastic songs, and so many songs as well. Who's been writing all the songs all the time?
Well, before Alan joined, I was writing and Cy was writing.
Yeah.
And then when Alan joined, he already had a catalogue of something like 200 songs.
Wow.
Most of which were great. In fact, I don't know if you know, there's recently been a release on, I think it was Cherry Red, of all Alan's demos.
Was it a CD collection they brought them all out on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's called Singing a Song in the Morning Light.
Right, and they're all on there?
Yeah, and it's like a sketch. I mean, some of them are very rough, just like a sketchbook from the demos he was making then. And, I mean, we're on some of them. Some of them it's just Alan. But it just shows what a wealth of talent and a wealth of material he had.
Yeah.
And, in fact, I must admit, Cy and I, as writers, got a bit lazy because of all the stuff that Alan was coming up with. I was lucky enough to write the first hit, which I don't know how Alan felt about that. Meet Me on the Corner was a song I'd had knocking around for a while.
Oh, what a classic, isn't it?
And it came out on the Fog on the Tyne album.
Yeah.
We'd had a couple of singles out before that, Clear White Light, which didn't do very much.
Yeah.
Lady Eleanor, which I think made a very low showing in the charts.
Yeah.
From the Fog on the Tyne album, Meet Me on the Corner was the lead single from that. And that just shot up, and it kind of kick-started the Fog on the Tyne album, which became the best-selling UK album of 1972.
Yeah.
And the record company re-released Lady Eleanor on the back of that, and it was a hit that time around.
Right. I always remember as I was about leaving school in about 1978. Is that the year that Run for Home came out?
78, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was after the band had broken up once in 73 and reformed in 78.
Yeah, I remember, I would be about 16, and I only just started DJing when I was about, I would say, 14 or 15. I started collecting records. I used to go on my bike, get the singles on my bike, in my bag, and come back with about 10 singles a week I was collecting. I always remember that song because it was on a pink record label.
Charisma, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it was on that. I can remember the pink record label, and I
with
used
a Mad Hatter on it.
That's the one. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I used to love playing that song, Run for Home. And my mum and dad used to have to put up with me practicing upstairs. And I was always playing it because it's such a great song. Yeah, that's the one that sticks in my mind just because of the memories, you know, You always attached them to what you were doing at the time. But it was a belting song, that. You were on Top of the Pops with that as well.
We were, yeah.
What was that like?
Well, we were on Top of the Pops earlier on. We did Meet Me on the Corner on Top of the Pops back in the early 70s. And then, again, we were on for Home.
Yeah. What was that like when you were on the TV? Was it just a real good laugh you were having, really? How did you go about it?
It was a real good laugh. I mean, lots of people remember from the first time round, Meet Me on the Corner, we raided the wardrobe department and all had sort of bizarre costumes on. And Ray Laidlaw was playing the bass drum with a rubber fish.
I'm going to dig that out later on and have a look at that.
People still ask about that.
Yeah. Yeah, because everybody looks like they're really enjoying themselves and the audience. How many times do they do that? Do you actually just do it in a one take, or is it? Do you get a couple of shots at it?
You have run throughs, but it's more for the camera angle. I mean, when you arrive there, they've got stagehands with dummy guitars standing about,
right?
So they can work out the camera angles and then tell you where to stand. I mean, Top of the Pops was usually mimed 100%, but sometimes it was a backing track with a live vocal.
Yeah.
And the Earl Grey Whistle Test was usually live.
Yeah.
Although not always. Sometimes there were overdubbed elements.
Yeah.
For instance, when we did Fog on the Tyne on the Earl Grey Whistle Test, I'm playing the bass and then I pick up the fiddle for the middle section and the bass mysteriously carries on while I'm playing the fiddle.
I used to love that, and trying to spot these things, weren't you, when people are on the television or bad miming sometimes.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Comical,
some
really.
Some people just couldn't be bothered.
Yeah, they didn't bother singing or miming to it, yeah. So what's your favourite song personally? You've had so many songs, it's a difficult one to say, but you must have like a few favourites.
Well, I've got to say Meet Me on the Corner, because although it's my song, it's been so good to me. It does kind of sum up the band's style in so many ways.
Yeah.
Sort of very rootsy sounding, almost a kind of busking kind of element to it. And it's, I'm proud to say it's stood the test of time. It still goes down great.
Yeah, and a lot of the songs haven't they? They've stood the test of time easily, really.
I think that's because it was always about the songs, first and foremost.
Yeah.
We had an upbringing in, as I said, in the folk clubs. And Alan particularly was influenced by other stuff he heard. There was, folk ballads. And there's quite a strong Irish community on Tyneside who brought their songs and ballads. And he picked up very early on the importance of telling a story.
Yeah.
Having a good chorus, putting hooks in, having a twist in the tail, oblique angle on something.
Yeah.
Into the songs. And when it comes to arranging songs, playing parts, working out what we're all going to play, it's always in the service of the song.
Yeah.
We've never been ones for extended solos and jamming and stuff like that. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Some people are great at it.
Yeah.
But for us, it's the songs first and foremost.
How do you go about writing a song then in the first place, Rod?
Oh, I wish I knew. I've been a bit remiss on the writing front in recent years. But it can happen in a variety of ways. Sometimes it's just things that you pick up people saying. Somebody might come out with a phrase that sticks in your mind. Or you can sit down and deliberately try to write a song in the style of another song, an existing song.
Yeah.
And when you finish it, you change it so it doesn't sound too much like what you were basing it on.
Yeah. Can you have like a purple day when you're really on it and you could write four or five songs easily?
Oh, yeah, definitely. The more you write, the more you write, and the better you write. I mean, sometimes I've been struggling over a particular song and a completely different one has popped out instead. Just out of nowhere.
Great, isn't it? That's a talent, though, isn't it? It's a real talent. And spotting them as well and then writing them as well. Fantastic talent.
Well, it is, yeah. It's a great thing to do, and I should really get back into it more. It's like they say, there's no such thing as luck. You've got to work at it.
Yeah, definitely.
You know that guy who said, the harder I work, the luckier I get.
True.
And, you've got to be in the room ready with your pen or your guitar in your hand for when inspiration does strike.
When you're on tour, I mean, you've done hundreds of songs, haven't you, over the years?
Yeah.
But how do you remember the arrangement for the song?
It's pretty much part of our DNA now.
Yeah. You just know, do you? You're doing it on autopilot nearly, are you?
Well, we try not to be on autopilot.
No, but I don't mean that. But I mean, it comes easily, does it, to think about what you've got to play?
It does come easily, yeah. Even if we haven't played together for a while, when we get back together, it just all falls back into place. You know, there's finger memory comes into play and taking cues from each other.
Yeah.
It's not difficult. It's so easy that it's fun.
Yeah. And is every time you do a song, is it slightly different each time you do it, would you say?
Yeah, it is. People might hear us one night to the next and the night after and not be able to tell the difference, perhaps, but
yeah,
there's always leeway for putting a little bit in. Or again, inspiration, you know, if inspiration strikes to change a line a little bit or something like that, then you can do it.
Yeah. How do you go on about sorting out all the transportation then of the, you know, going from gig to gig? Who sorts all that out?
We do it ourselves. We don't have a manager. We're self-managed.
Yeah.
We have an agent, and who gets the gigs for us and helps organise the publicity. We've got a guy who does the PR, Peter Muir.
Yeah.
And we travel with a crew of two, our regular sound man and a tour manager who sorts out the day-to-day things actually at the gig.
Yeah.
And we usually travel in three vehicles, two white vans and a hire car.
Right. So you're going to be doing a lot of that then coming up soon, aren't you? Because you say,
we certainly are, yeah.
You're travelling all around the UK. I mean, is there some places you've never been before on the tour this year?
Some areas we don't get to very often.
Yeah.
The West Country is one of them. North of Scotland. I mean, we haven't done an awful lot in Scotland over the years, but we're starting to now.
Yeah.
We've got, obviously, areas we're pretty strong in. I mean, the North East,
yeah,
obviously. But South Wales as well. And London seems to do pretty well too.
Yeah, and the O2 Academy venues as well. You've got Bournemouth, Leicester, and then Shepherd's Bush. And you're also down for the town that we're actually here at in the studio, Lytham St Anne's.
Yes, I remember it well from last year. Had a great gig. Enjoyed it very much. Very nice place. Nice room to play in. Lovely tea room next door.
That's what counts. Yeah. Do you get time to actually go round any places when you're on tour? Is it too busy for that?
It depends on the length of travel to get there, really.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it's just get there, set up, sound check, do the gig, go straight off to the hotel. But if it's short distance and we get chucked out of the hotel at, say, 12 o'clock and you get to the next place for 2 o'clock, we'll have time for a look around.
Yeah.
Get a bite of lunch and so forth.
Yeah. Well, thanks for taking the time to speak to us anyway. I wish you and the band all the very best for 2024. It's been an absolute...
Thanks very much. I'll pass that on.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Rod, talking to you. Thanks for that. And maybe we'll catch up again, you know, maybe this time next year and find out if you're doing another massive tour of 60 dates. Okay.
I look forward to that. I look forward to that. Thanks a lot, Nigel.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Rod. And catch up soon.
Okay. Cheers for now.
If you loved what you heard, make sure to hit subscribe on this podcast channel to never miss an episode. Stay connected and become part of the Sans Showbiz family by following us on our social media platforms. See you next time.